So this is the Friday morning talk on the November 2009 retreat at Jhana Grove. And yesterday, I like to make my talks relevant to especially some of the questions, and also to allow the talks to be sequential, so they build up more and more understanding of what we're doing here and why we're doing it and how we do it. And yesterday somebody asked me, can you please explain on what you really mean by seeing the Dhamma? So this is a continuation of the talk on insight to start relating how these insights actually do, you know, change your life and change the way you look at things. And even just to change things so much that many of the ideas which one was attached to, many of the perceptions which one took for granted are changed. In such a way to give you a greater sense of freedom in this life, and also the opportunity to, you know, end all this rebirth and suffering once and for all. And one of the insights which I never talked about yesterday, which, because you ran out of time, was traditionally when the Buddha was talking about the enlightenment process, he would often say it takes a form of three great insights. This is called the Te Wija, the three great insights. And he said the first of those great insights, is once actually in one sutta described it as like a chicken coming out of its egg. And it's the three cracks. Now, the first crack when it sort of, you know, puts its beak through, and the second when its head comes through, and the third crack when it totally emerges from its egg, as a simile of you emerging from the illusion which causes suffering. And so there's three cracks in the egg, the three stages, the three insights. The first is remembering your past lives. And the second is understanding the law of karma. And the third is the Four Noble Truths. This is what's meant by seeing the Dhamma. And sometimes that people just shy away from such things. But that's right there in the heart of the Buddha's teachings. So what it actually means, you know, why are we so concerned about seeing our past lives, especially when throughout this whole retreat I told you to let go of your past, and now you're deliberately bringing it up. And the reason is because it gives you the big picture. It gives you the whole story. So you're not just neglecting, you know, part of your existence, you know, which happened before your consciousness developed in this life. And it does change the whole attitude you have to life if you can remember your past lives and know them to be real, not illusions, but something which is as true as the fact you were here yesterday and the day before. So because when I was reading those suttas, you know, you noticed that point and it stood out at you, that for that time on I've been encouraging other people to try that practice, try to remember your past lives. And the best way to do it is either, again, just coming out of jhana, or even sometimes just before, when you've just got a really powerful meditation. And some of you had powerful meditations already during this retreat. As you're coming out, you ask yourself the question, at least this is the way which I developed it, you ask yourself the question, what is my earliest memory? Now, of course, that was the technique which I used. You may adapt that to yourself, but I found that very, very effective. And for those of you who never heard, you know, the story, and again, I have to be careful when I talk about past lives, because I am a monk who keeps the rules of Vinaya very strictly. I keep my monastic precepts. And one of them, as the bhikkhunis would know, is the eighth paticca, which prevents you from telling other people about, you know, things like your memory of past lives. Or, you know, I've been very careful sometimes with jhanas. I never say I've got this jhana or that jhana, because I'm not allowed to say that except to other monks. So you just say you had a deep meditation. It's a bit of a trick, but I'd sort of bend that rule as far as I can. But when it comes to past lives, I bend that rule because it only refers to remembering your previous lives. It never talks about remembering this life, or especially early on in this life. And so that I've told many of you the story that when I was first doing this practice of coming out of deep meditations and then starting to say, what's my earliest memory? The experience which happened was almost immediately after I made that suggestion. So a smell came into my nostrils. And I recognized that smell almost immediately as the smell of my baby's pram. They used to call it a pram in those days. I think it's called a, what's it, a push? Stroller. And with that memory, a recognition of that smell was the smell of my baby's pram. Again, the next moment I was back in my pram, my stroller, as a maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks old baby. I didn't know exactly the time, but very, very young. Back there, and being able to see, feel, smell everything which was around me, as if it was, I was back there. It was one of those memories which were very different than, you remember what you had for breakfast this morning. It was actually you're right back there, living that experience. And also with the ability to move around, just to see and inspect what's going on. And one of the memories of that experience was the memory of my favourite toy as an infant, which was a light blue pig. Maybe it's about the same colour as the blanket set, that type of blue. And it was made out of, I don't know if it was even plastic, I think it was made out of ceramic, and with maybe some beads inside. And so when you shake it, it made a noise. And it was standing upright, and my mother would move it from one leg to another to make it walk. And I love that little pig as a 4 or 5 week old baby. So all these memories started coming back of what it's like to be freshly born. What struck me about that experience was how real it was. Far different than the memory of this age, what you had for breakfast or where you came from before you came here. This was right back there, reliving it, being able to investigate what's going on around you. And that's the sign that these are real, real memories coming from meditation. And of course, afterwards when I came out, I remembered all those details. And of course, I couldn't check many of them, but when I talked to one person, he happened to be a doctor, a medical doctor, and he was quite taken by that because he told me something I never knew before, and that was that in your early weeks of life, the sense which is dominant is your sense of smell. You recognize your surroundings by their smell, not by their sight or feel or sound, by how they smell. And I know that now as a personal experience, verified it from that memory. I recognize my mother from her smell, nothing else. And so to this day, I tell people, mothers who've just given birth, please, in the first few weeks of your baby's life, don't change your perfume. It would confuse the hell out of your kid. They won't know who this is. And that's really true, because they recognize you by how you smell. So those are little insights which come up, and you can take it further. Earlier, please, or earlier, please. Now, of course, when you do this, there's a problem comes up. If you do actually manage to get that degree of stillness, the hindrances are gone. The Buddha actually says your mind becomes malleable, workable. You can actually do things with it. If that actually comes up in your meditation, you go earlier, please. It's common the first past life memory you get. The closest to this life, and one of the most strong, is the memory of your previous death. And a few meditators have got that memory, and of course, it's a little bit scary, obviously. Some people die quite unpleasant deaths. So because of that, if that ever happens to you, and you get back to something which is a past life, don't sort of abandon it yet. Just quickly say, earlier, please. And it's if you press the rewind button, you go earlier into that previous life, rather than staying on this end point of your previous life, which is sometimes unpleasant and makes you really not want to stay there any longer. And that way you can get back and actually feel this previous life. And once you get one, then it's easy to get some others as well, and you actually find out just the whole sequence of lives you've lived. People who do that get a huge different perspective on life and death, marriage, accumulation of things, your status in this world. And sometimes, obviously, you can get trends, just know why you are who you are and why you act the way you do. You know, because those characters have been there not just in this life but in previous lives. I mean, look at me, what am I doing as a monk? You know, so born in sort of England when none of my family, as I often joke, could even spell the word Buddhist, let alone know anything which it was about. And you end up being a monk. I mean, how could that happen? And it's obvious why. So you can find out from previous lives just all the characteristics and why you are who you are. And it gives you a really big picture and answers many questions. But one of the things it really gives you is a sense of like ennui and boredom. Now here we go again, another life. It puts it all in perspective. So yeah, here you go, another life, you go to school again, then you get married again, you know, you sort of get divorced again. You have all the same old problems which you had last time. But here we go again. Then you start to get old, you get sick, you have problems at work, and then you have to retire, and your kids don't do what they're told, and all sorts of problems. And then you sort of, you get really sick, and then you die, and it's painful. And if you actually see the whole big picture, you know, it gives this sense to you that, you know, this whole thing about life and death, you know, this cycle of rebirth, have you had enough yet? A lot of people, they haven't had enough because, you know, they don't see the bigger picture. You've been many, many things before. You've done it. You've been there and done almost everything. So there comes a time when you think, no, just I've had enough. I want out of here. It's only when you see that bigger picture, it does give you, you know, the full picture of why the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree. You know, to end suffering was by ending this rebirth process. That's the whole point of what we're doing here. To stop getting reborn again. Some people say, oh, it's really negative. What do you mean, don't get reborn? I can have another try. You know, the love of my life, you know, there's 30, 40, 50, 60 years with him or her. That's not enough. I want to be with you again for your next life. So, like, say, in Thai tradition, you know, with your wife, your husband, together, you offer food to the monks. You know, together, you hold a spoon together and put rice in the bowl. And the reason they say that, the karmic cause of that is you've been married to that person again, next life. And I know I've actually explained that to people while they've been offering food. The Thai girl has got their Western husband and said, no, hold a spoon together. And then I explain why, and the husband takes his hand away as quick as he can. He doesn't realize what his wife is doing. One life does enough. But that's just a little bit of a superstition there. But when you see the bigger picture, I remember reading this one story. It's actually in a Thai newspaper of a girl, you know, who could spontaneously remember her past lives. And because she remembered her past life, she refused to get married. You know, even though in her family, you know, that it was considered to be something a bit strange if you didn't find a husband. But she was intelligent, she was good looking. But she said, no, look, I've been there, I know what it's like, I don't want to do it again. And I think most of you might think the same, if you could only remember when you're 18 or 19. But the thing is, we forget, and that's a big problem. So it gives us a big picture, and it has consequences in the way you look at your life. And of course it has consequences in the way we sort of understand things like death. It's one of the biggest fears which people have in our modern world, is dying. If you only could realize you've done it before, many, many times. So when you get to that old age and sick, it's here we go again. You know, being there, done that, you're not afraid of it anymore. Only just make sure this time you do it properly, so you don't have to come back again. But when you see what the problem actually is of rebirth, and those of you who asked about dependent origination, the 12 factors which explain rebirth without a soul, without an entity which gets reborn, we should actually recognize that when the Buddha was contemplating this, what he wanted to find out the answer to was, what's the answer to suffering? Why is there suffering in this world? It's one of those questions, you know, which has obviously bothered you, but also bothers philosophers and religions. And I remember just when I was investigating other religions, you know, I looked in the Christian Bible on the book of Job, which is supposed to try and address the problem of suffering. It's why suffering? And the answer to that particular book was just so totally arrogant and sort of unconvincing. The answer was, who are you to ask the question? You know, if God wants to give you suffering, it's, you know, it's his whim. So just shut up and take it. And that was not really satisfying for me. And nor was it satisfying to say, yeah, take some suffering. There's something in it for you. You know, sometimes I do say that. I put my hand up. Sometimes I teach nice little Dhamma, like, if you have suffering, it's just more shit for your mango tree. Dig it in, 1 year later your mangoes will be sweeter. Yeah, but, you know, how much shit do you really need on a mango tree? So in the end, sometimes we see, no, come, there's a problem here. And that all we can do is to try and make this life better, and it doesn't work. Have you been trying to fix up your life? Trying to get your guts together, your relationship together, your monastery together? You know, you can't do it. Even this retreat center, so many millions of dollars. And still, you know, sometimes the bamboo bends. Sometimes I'm not sure if it still happens, the toaster turns on the fire alarm. There's all sorts of stuff happens here. It doesn't matter how much you try, it still doesn't work. Now there's a message there. No matter how much you try, you still can't get your mind quiet. Now haven't you got some message there? There's something actually not wrong with you, but wrong with the system. And it's when the Buddha saw that, he said, look, you know, once you get born, things start going wrong from that time. As soon as you turn something on, that's when it goes off. So if one gets the idea from this, there is like an inherent unsatisfactoriness, pain, difficulty in this thing which we call human life. And all the wishful thinking in the world that, you know, if we get a beautiful government, if we get the right President of the United States, Barack Obama, he's going to fix up everything. They should know better than that. Or if you get like, no, not Barack Obama, get Ajahn Brahm to be president, he'll fix everything. No, I never will be able to. I'd just be even worse, probably. Or whatever you think, you just can't fix it. Now, much of your life has been fixing things. And after a while, you should get the message, no, it doesn't matter how much you try, it can't be fixed. Once you get that out of your skull, trying to fix up life, there's only one other solution. Make sure this is the last life, so you don't get born again. And that's the first great insight which Buddha had with dependent origination. Having seen the extent of suffering, then you realize there's only one way out, not to get reborn again. Without that understanding of many lives, you'll never be able to even start understanding about what the problem is and what the solution is, how to end being reborn. Now I'm going to stop there, because seeing the Dhamma is realizing Four Noble Truths, that this life is like a broken apparatus with an inherent problem, and the only solution is to stop getting reborn. And that's when the insights really start getting interesting. How can you stop getting reborn? Many people have come up to me and said, I don't want to get reborn again. He said, yeah, so does about 50 million other people, 50 billion other people. I don't know how many people on this. How many people on the planet now? So do 6 billion other people mostly. But not wanting just makes you get reborn again. In the same way that not wanting thoughts to come in your mind when you're meditating, the more come in. Not wanting is not good enough. Not wanting just creates more momentum to get you reborn. So when we really practice insight, then we realize that's the problem, Now what is the solution? How do we stop getting reborn? And as I mentioned last night, that the two reasons why people get reborn, or the two forces which make you reborn. Number one is your karmic wherewithal, just your spiritual capital, your money if you like, which says, yeah, you can go to a heaven realm or a beautiful life in this planet, be intelligent or whatever, how much really good karma you've accumulated. But really, that's not the main cause. That's just what you make use of to come here and go there. The reason why you get reborn anywhere is because of will, craving, because you want to. Now, it's a very difficult thing to stop that wanting, as you've all found out. So, really what we're doing here, on this retreat, and all the retreats I do, is learning to understand what this wanting, what this will truly is. This important part of the mind, which drives you from moment to moment, day to day, life to life even. The same movement which got you out from your heart into here, is the same movement which takes you from one life to another. And for many of you that's totally uncontrollable, unstoppable. It just happens in spite of you. So, we're learning about that will, understanding it, and most importantly, learning how to calm it down. If you do learn how to calm down that will, it's called letting go, letting things be. Being kind, being gentle, being peaceful, being patient. You can all recognize by those four things, there's the subduing of the sankharas of the will. Once you start to learn how to stop that will, even sitting here, you don't go anywhere. The body doesn't move, and eventually the mind doesn't move. You learn how to be still. If you can practice that enough, it means that when you die, those last moments can be totally still. If you're still long enough, the buzz which takes you to the next life can't find you and leaves without you, so you don't get reborn ever again. But if you move slightly, then off you go, you get reborn again. Some of my lovely anecdotes which I've picked up about getting reborn. Three people have come up to me and told me similar stories. And I know another fourth person who had this experience just by reading. And it was the stories of people who, when they were born, or very shortly afterwards, could speak. The first couple this happened to came up one evening at Nolamara. They were scared, they said, because something had happened a few days before which they just couldn't believe had occurred. They had two children. One was only newly born, 3, 4, 5 days old, I can't remember now. The other one was about 2 or 3 years of age. One Peter, one Paul. And it was Peter's job, 2 or 3 year old, sorry. It came time for their bedtime, so Mum and Dad told Peter, just go and say goodnight to your baby brother. You know, the 2 or 3 year olds, they just do what your mum and dad says. It'd be great if they kept on doing that when they're 14, 15, 16, but when you're 2 or 3, they do what mum and dad says. And so he went over to the stroller, leant over and said, good night, Paul. And then Paul said, good night, Peter. It's a great story because, you know, they were just shocked. Did we hear that? And what happened next was they stopped doing whatever they were doing and they stared in disbelief at the stroller and their two children. And without any encouragement, Peter said again, good night, Paul. And this time they were watching. And Paul said, good night, Peter. What's happening? So they came and told us. And the second time, you know, I told that story several times, and there was a Malaysian couple here in Perth, and they came up after one of the times I told that story, and they said, that's weird, We never had the guts to tell anybody, but that happened to our child as well. Spoke when he was newly born. And, you know, we thought that people would say we were crazy, but we both heard it. That was the second. But the best one, the best story, which I'm sure you remember, was he was in the United States. And this was in the maternity ward. And the baby had literally seconds just come out of the mother's womb. And in front of the doctor, the midwives, whoever else was there, the little baby, you know, just straight out of the womb, looked around and said these unforgettable words, "Oh no, not again." That's what he said. A brilliant saying. That was really a wise person. "Oh no, not again. More nappies. Every time I want something, my mother shoves this thing in my mouth to keep me quiet. And having to go to school all over again. You know, having to deal with boyfriends and girlfriends and getting a job. My God, haven't you had enough of that?" "Oh no, not again." But at least he had some wisdom. He knew what was in front of him. So a wise person who understands about, you know, what this life is all about, will realize they just don't want to get reborn again. And the way that happens is by learning how to be so still at the time of your death so you can really can let go of everything. The only reason we can't be still, you know, is because we're afraid of disappearing. We're not ready to die yet because we haven't really seen there's nothing to lose. So it means that really seeing the Dhamma is not just seeing sort of your previous lives and getting the big picture. It's not just seeing just the karma, how rebirth takes place. But in order to let go of all of that, you have to realize you're not going to lose anything by not getting reborn again. And that's where we have to find out deep inside that there is no person called Ajahn Brahm. There is nobody inside. And that's the toughest of insights to get. And that's the key one. That is to see the emptiness inside, to see the non-self. It's standard. This is not just Mahayana Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism. We make all these distinctions between all these different types of Buddhism, but really there's no distinction whatsoever. Just, you know, the paths may be different, but the goals are the same. There's only one Dhamma, there's only one truth. And I still remember this great story of Ajahn Chah. You know, just maybe, must have been only about a year before I came to Perth, and which was only about sort of 15 months before he stopped talking. He had a stroke. So this was one of his last teachings, and it was a personal one. It was one of these ones which was so powerful. Because by this time he was already getting sick. He was having dizzy spells. We found out there was like water on the brain causing pressure on his brain somewhere and getting very dizzy. No one really knew what it was at the time. But anyway, he was getting sick and we thought that we started reading the old sutras, the stories in the time of the Buddha, and found out that 2,500 years ago in the monasteries in India they had saunas. Saunas were not invented by the Swedish. 25 centuries ago, they were in India. Jantagars was their party name, literally fire rooms, where the monks would heat themselves up to sweat out any impurities. It's a sauna. So we decided, let's build a sauna for our teacher. And when we built a sauna, it might improve his health, but it also makes sure he comes to our monastery once a week for his sauna, because we knew if he'd come to the monastery where the Western monks were, he'd also give us a talk. So it was like a win-win for us. You know, we'd sort of give service to our teacher, and at the same time get a talk out of him. So it worked perfectly. Well, for the talks it worked perfectly, not his health. But, you know, we didn't really know that. We're trying our best. So every week he would come and give a talk to all the Western monks. And so after the talk, you know, he'd have his sauna. But I already mentioned that please make use of inspiration to really enhance your depth of your meditation. Because when you get inspired, it's so easy to meditate. So this Ajahn Chah gave a very powerful talk on this one occasion. And it was just really hit the spot and I was just so inspired. And there's many other monks who could help him with his soreness. So I decided, okay, I'll let them help my teacher this time. I went behind the hall and I just found a quiet place where no one could see me, and I sat down and meditated. And I got into a very, very deep meditation. It's beautiful because I've been inspired. And after the meditation was finished, I came out. I hadn't got any clue what the time was. But the first thought which came up in my mind, let's see if I can still find my teacher and do some service for him. So I went towards the sauna. And at that time I realized I was too late, because Ajahn Chah was coming in the opposite direction. He'd already finished. It was only a narrow path we had to cross. He was come with two Thai men. They'd obviously were his drivers, taking him back to his monastery, only about 6 kilometers away. So we had to cross on the path. And again, Ajahn Chah, he did have psychic powers, and he could read people's minds, and this was one occasion when he was going to read my mind. You could tell, he really looked at me, and you could feel him looking right into me. Because he saw, you know, by the smile on my face, so that my mind was free and clear. So he looked at me, and he, like people do, they can grab you with their eyes, and you can't take your eyes away. And he grabbed my eyes with his, and said, "Pramawangso!" Fiercely. "Why?" And in Thai, "Tamai." "Why?" And so he's really trying his best to enlighten me. You know, just why? You know, what's this life all about? Why? And I answered. This was my answer. And I've been a monk about 8 years at this time. "I don't know." At least I was being honest. You know, it's close to being honest. "I don't know." Question, well, I'm still trying to find out. And the great experiences with these amazing monks is they never get angry at you. Even though you're the stupidest thing they've ever seen, they just think it's so funny. So every time we did something stupid, he would just burst out laughing. And in fact, you know, the stupid Western monks, we gave him so much entertainment over those years. I remember him saying once about, what do you like eating? And I said, I meant to say beans, and beans is tua, but I said toy, which means plate. He said, "What?" And he heard, "I like eating plates, they're very good. You know, I used to be a vegetarian before, plates are nice." And he said, "You just break all your teeth." So you always tell that, "Don't these Westerners, you know what they eat in England? They eat plates." So we gave him lots of merriment, but on this occasion, when I said, "I don't know," he just laughed his head off. He thought it was so funny, how stupid we were. But then he stopped, and he screwed his eyes up again. And I realized he was being serious again, and he held my eyes again. And he said, "Pramawangso, I'll tell you the answer." And I got really excited. Because this was the point. I was going to get the answer to this from this amazing monk. You know, the highest authority alive I could get it from. The answer to the question, why? The big question. He said, "This is the answer." And he said, "It's my mitarai. There's nothing. Nothing there. That's the answer to the question, why?" I thought, wow. And he said, "Do you understand?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." And he walked away. That's just a wonderful interlude with a great master. But, you know, why did he actually say that to me? Because, you know, he knew I'd think about that and contemplate. And that was brilliant. This is what the answer is. This is a great insight. There's nothing there. Emptiness, anatta, why? There's nothing. And wow, this is what you actually find out in more and more meditation. But giving you that little clue, there's nothing, will give you something to look for. In the deepest of meditations, what's left? Is there anything left? In the deepest of meditation, anything solid there? Anything constant? Already mentioned that when the lake disappears, what's left? Anything left? You get into the deepest meditations, first jhana, what's left? Second, anything left? Anything left? And after a while, it's like peeling the onion. Nothing left. There's a jewel in the heart of the lotus. The mani in Om Mani Padme Hum.
I think. Scary for some people. But such a huge relief when you see it. Nothing left. I can let go then. Because there's nothing here to keep anyway. I can disappear. Because I wasn't really there all the time. Just this whole process. When one does things like this, one sees the Dhamma. And there's a beautiful simile which the Buddha gave about what we mean by seeing the Dhamma. He said it's a simile of the shipwrecked sailors. He said there were 7 sailors, shipwrecked, a long way from the coast. They're in the water. And the first of the shipwrecked sailors, they manage to keep afloat only for a few seconds. And then they go down, 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 down. Second shipwrecked sailor goes up, down, up, down, up, down, until they get so tired, they go down. The third shipwrecked sailor can actually float. Stays up, keeps his head above water. The fourth shipwrecked sailor not only keeps his head or her head above water, but looks around and sees dry land. He can see the shore in the distance. That's the fourth shipwrecked sailor. The fifth shipwrecked sailor, now they floated above the surface, they've looked around, they've seen where the dry land is a few minutes ago. Now they're swimming towards it. And the sixth shipwrecked sailor, they've also been swimming towards the shore, they've seen it too. But they're so close to the shore, they don't need to swim anymore. They're standing and just wading through the surf. And the seventh shipwrecked sailor has already swam home and is sitting under a coconut tree, having a beautiful cup of tea. That was not in the original sutta. But that's good enough. And the meaning of that simile, which the Buddha gave, he said the first shipwrecked sailor, just that's the person who's never done anything good for anybody in this world. They haven't got much good karma. So they just go down. Always going down into more and more suffering and problems in this life and the next one. You see people like that. You know, sometimes they come to the monastery for help. You try to help them, but they just won't accept it, and they just go into more problems and suffering. And there's the accumulated karma is not really good enough to get them out of their problems. And the second one, they go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. They almost make it, and then they're down. And the third one is the person who's got lots of good karma. They always float. They keep their head above water, no matter what happens to them in life. They get some terrible things happen to them, might be cancers, divorces, problems, whatever. But you know, you've got enough good karma, you can always float. So that's why in this simile it just shows you the importance of, you know, being generous, keeping your precepts, being kind, doing acts of service. Because that's part of the path, you can't divorce that from the path. You've got to be able to float before you can see dry land. And the seeing of the dry land, that's seeing the Dhamma. Seeing security. Seeing that there is an end to things. Seeing non-self. And as soon as you see there's no one there, that's called being a stream winner. You actually understood, you know, what this life is all about and where you should be going instead of always bobbing up and down. Sometimes having some happiness, sometimes having some suffering and getting born and dying and born and dying. Up and down you go. For a person who can see that, obviously the next thing they'll do is start swimming towards that dry land. And that's the once returner. You get so close, you're standing up on the surf. Yeah, the water's around your legs, but you can stand now. And it's very easy just to walk the last few meters. And the seventh one is a fully enlightened being, sitting under a coconut tree having a cup of tea. That's my English definition of enlightened being. You're free, you're safe at last. And that's the Buddha's definition, or one of the similes, which actually shows what this is all about. Now, I'm giving it to you sort of, you know, as deep as possible, because sometimes the people say, what are you talking to lay people about this for? This is monk and nun's business. But I thought, no, I mean, you deserve to know as much as everyone else does, and you're trying your best, and I respect you enough, so I can give you all the teachings. Now, don't hold anything back. That's what enlightenment is, when you disappear. And that will happen to you sooner or later. You know, you're meditating and get deep and say, well, you know, there's no will left in here. You know, there's even this consciousness, this disappears. What actually happens, it's like you've got this TV set. And the TV set's got 6 channels on it. Only 6 channels. One channel is called sight channel. The other one is called sound channel. The other one is called smell channel, taste channel, touch channel, and lastly of all, mind channel. That's the weirdest one. But 6 channels on there. And just like anybody else, you surf the channels, now seeing something, now hearing something, now knowing it, now smelling it. In a couple of hours, you'd be tasting it, your lunch. Go through all these channels. And you know, sometimes you turn the channel off, but you've still got the screen there. But then one day you're meditating, and you get to mind channel. And it's not just the mind channel turns off, even the screen disappears. Just like the lake disappears. It's not just the channel that's turned off, it actually goes and vanishes. Just like your body, when you're meditating, you can feel it, and then it's not you don't feel it anymore, it's gone. The whole screen on which, say, physical touch plays out disappears. And what that shows you is these 6 channels, what we call the 6 consciousnesses, even they vanish. Because as well as I've already mentioned about will, the doer, what about the knower? Are you the one looking at me behind your eyes? Is there someone there just a couple of inches behind your eyes? Sometimes that's our perception, that's what it feels like. So often human beings have identified their consciousness as being somewhere in their body. That's why for many people, even Asians, they always thought it was in your heart somewhere. So when that South African surgeon, Dr. Christian Barnard, did the first heart transplant, people were really worried. The person who gets a new heart, who are they going to wake up as? The owner of the heart or the owner of the body in which it was placed? People were really scared. You might think that, that's stupid, that's so naive. But what when we do the first brain transplant? Say, you know, when you need a new brain, and I've used mine, so you get Ajahn Brahm's brain. Or when you come out of surgery, will you tell stupid jokes? Or will you be the same as you were before? Who will you be? Actually, there's some interesting stories, nothing to do with this talk, but we had a book about heart transplants, because sometimes there is a time, actually, obviously you wake up as the one you were before, you know, the body outside, not the heart. But a few times people had heart transplants, they've got some remnant of the owner of the previous heart. I had like a book of stories like this, and it's a brilliant little book, very funny. And one of the most interesting stories was a little girl that had some heart problem, and they managed to find a donor heart for her, and they put it in, and she survived. So that after her transplant was finished, and after, you know, a few, I don't know how many days or weeks, whatever it was, in hospital, she went home, and she started having nightmares. And so the mother sort of took her to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, you know, this is a very traumatic operation. You know, there's lots of drugs in there to stop her rejecting the tissue, so, yeah, there's all sorts of things going to happen. Forget about it. But the nightmares were consistent. She was dreaming that she was walking down an alley and was murdered. And the detail was so clear that the mother started thinking, I wonder. So she went to the police station and she asked, has anyone like this in this situation been murdered? And the police said, well, actually there was a murder like that. Could you check, please, where my daughter's heart came from? And the daughter's heart came from a woman who'd been murdered in an alley. And the police were so intrigued, they took all the details, and from the details, from this little daughter's nightmares, they found a suspect, interviewed him, and he confessed. She'd actually remembered the details where that heart came from. Amazing story. But the funniest one was this middle-aged lady. I've got to be very careful. I was going to say an old woman, but I've got to be careful in the company which we have today. She was maybe about 50. I'm going to get in trouble for this.
when she was about 50, and she needed a heart transplant. And you know, this is interesting for that person who wrote about her wife with menopause. This is no solution to your problem. Listen what happened. So she's in her 50s, early 50s. She had to have a heart transplant. So, you know, they found a heart for her. And then sort of, you know, she recovered and she went back home. And again, the sort of the husband was actually quite delighted with the operation, because as soon as she was fit enough, she wanted sex all the time with her husband. In her husband's words, she was very frisky. And so when he did some research, he found that, yeah, the person who had the heart before was a prostitute who was murdered. So he got this, you know, young girl prostitute's heart. So that's a solution to, you know, your wife who has menopause. I think I only had a bug to get away with these stories. That's in the book, isn't it? But anyway, so you have a brain transplant, who are you going to wake up as? Because sometimes we think the, you know, the mind is something to do with the body. But when you get into deep meditation, the whole body disappears. So there you've got your mind, and it's again not contaminated with other things. All the five, six senses, you've got the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, disappear. Now you've just got mind, just mind, nothing else but mind. And that's actually when you get into, even nimittas, that's just pure mind. You get the first jhana, you really are into pure mind states. And the reason why you have all these second jhanas, third jhanas, fourth jhanas, immaterial states, because as you go deep into these jhanas, what's happening is your mind is vanishing. It's disappearing. Consciousness is stopping. How can consciousness stop if it's always you, it's always there? It's like your soul is stopping, it's fading away, it's disappearing in front of your mental eyes. This is where we get the data, one of the most powerful datas, that the knower is also impermanent, subject to change, to solution, to stopping, ceasing. You aren't even the one who knows, let alone the one who does. Both of those, what I call the two last citadels of the self, even those two. You don't think this out. You see it, you experience it. Nothing to do with me. Just processes, that's all. The result of that is life changing. And it's actually life stopping. To see that there's nobody in there. This great truth of emptiness, anatta, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, my mirror, nothing there. That has huge consequences in your destiny. When you see there's nothing in there, it's a truth you will never forget. What it means is, what the heck are you doing here? Just this empty process. According to the Buddha, at most seven lifetimes. Until, you know, you've seen it, you just, what's the point, you just let it go. Till it all fades away and you stop. You leave samsara. At most, usually much quicker than that. This is where letting go is very easy to do, because you've got nothing to lose. The reason why we can't let go is we're afraid of losing things. We're afraid of losing control. We're afraid of losing consciousness. We're afraid of what's going to happen when all my defense mechanisms aren't there. When you've got nothing to lose, it means you're totally free. This is what happens. You get less and less and less knowing and doing, more and more stillness and peace. It's not as if it's a terrible thing. As you go out in a blaze of glory, sometimes I consider it to be like a meteor or like a comet just rolling around the solar system in its orbit. 100 billion years, no, not 100 billion years, it's only 14 billion years we've been going. Now, tens of billions, 10 billion years going round and 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 round. And then it meets a planet. And when it gets into the atmosphere of that planet, it burns up like a shooting star in a beautiful blaze of glory, just for a few moments, and then it's gone forever. And that's just like you. You've met the Dhamma. So you're going to go out in a blaze of glory. The beautiful life of these saints, the Ajahn Chahs. Amazing beings, wonderful to be around. So peaceful, so still, but ones who own nothing. One of the other great stories of Ajahn Chah is just, again, just before I came to Perth, I was under his hut, and he asked me, can you get something from my room? And I was so excited because his room, his living quarters, was out of bounds for all monks. Now he was asking me to go up in there and have a look. And I was just so excited to see, this is supposed to be an enlightened monk. How does he live? What's he got in his room? And when I went inside, wow, there was nothing there. And this was a great monk. At this time, again, the Queen had been up to see him, Queen of Thailand. So all these generals and important people. But in his room there was nothing. There was a straw mat, a wooden pillow, and a run robe, I think, on the line. It was just so empty, and I thought, wow, that is a great monk. So famous, people giving all sorts of stuff, but he collects absolutely nothing. As his room, so his mind, totally empty. He came with nothing, and he left with even more nothing. So that's what we mean by seeing the Dharma. This is actually what happens when you sort of practice this path. And don't think, oh, this is a bit too much for me, I'm getting out while I've still got a chance. I'm sorry, fellows, ladies, it's already too late. It's true, once you actually hear these things and listen to them, you just can't get them out of your head. You have to go and either disprove them or find them to be true, and they are true, and you find that in your deep meditation. You have a beautiful, wonderful time getting deep and still and emptying out. And then you understand what this Buddhist teaching is all about. That's what enlightenment really is. Sometimes, as some of the monks in my monastery pointed out, even that word enlightenment is not a good translation. The real translation of Buddha, not the enlightened one, but the awakened one. And, you know, I agree with my monks now. That's a much better word to describe the Buddha, the awakened one. It's as if, you know, you're waking up from a dream, from the delusion of, you know, thinking that, you know, you're in there somewhere. When you wake up, you think, wow, there's no one in there. And actually, that's quite good. It's bloody good. It's the only way to be. Empty. So that's why, when people asked me about a year ago, how should we address you, Ajahn Bhav? That's why I said, your emptiness. And the emptiness is over there as well. So that's a much better thing to call a monk. Your emptiness. Her emptiness, Ajahn Wayama. Okay, so, any questions about seeing the Dhamma? Okay, Kemanti, I know you, because when you talk like this, you get people thinking a lot. Yeah? Oh, why people had that? Now that's a very interesting question. Why did people actually have those memories? Are they somehow like stored just for, it's only actually for a few days. And then all those memories disappeared after a few weeks, and then they came totally back to the personality of the recipient of the heart. It was only just for a few days that happened. But apparently it does happen in a few cases like that. Very hard to say whether it was actually the ghost of the old, because those were two violent deaths. The ghost was still hanging around, could actually still connect with the person through the heart. Now that's one possibility. And that's actually the possibility which I would actually put my money on if I did have any money. But, you know, the doctors will say, you know, maybe some memories are actually stored in some of the cells of the heart, and they eventually just get overwhelmed by the other cells in the body. But I'm not sure. I reckon it was a ghost contacting it through that, especially through dreams. What do you reckon? Because you were a biochemist, whatever. Okay. A ghost is just, this is, when a person dies, just like the people who have near-death experiences, they make a mind-made body, that's a continuation of the process into that particular state. And sometimes you can be there for a long time, especially if you have unfinished business, like making sure there's justice, because people demand justice, but what they really mean is revenge.
whoever killed them, they really want to sort of get their own back. So sometimes that happens and you get stuck there until you, you know, settle your business. Yes, Daniel. When we let go of the past in the way I've been teaching now, we let go of one particular type of memory. And that's the memory which is, you know, the uncertain memories. Sometimes I wondered why it is that what I remembered in the past wasn't true, where it all went wrong. And I realized that, you know, just through mindfulness, insight, what we take as a memory, if I remember, say, two weeks ago when I was in Thailand, I don't actually remember being in Thailand. I remember the last time I remembered being in Thailand. So I remember the last time I remembered being in Thailand, and that was the time previously I remembered being in Thailand. And so my memory is actually a whole link of memories. And because of a whole link, you remember the last time you remembered it. What actually happens, it's so similar to that game we used to play as school children called Chinese Whispers, where whole people stand in the line and the teacher tells the first kid something, and the next kid, that kid tells the next kid tells the one next to them, and they get to the end of the line and see how close it was to the original message. And the classic case of this was not done in school, but was done actually in the First World War, in the chain of command. And the story was the general, you know, in the general's quarters, you know, told the colonel, you know, send reinforcements, we're going to advance. That was the message. Send reinforcements, we're going to advance. And that got sent to the colonel, who gave it to the major, who gave it to the captain, who gave it to the lieutenant, who gave it to the sergeant, who gave it to the corporal, who gave it to the private. And when the private heard it, what he heard, you know, the old English money, send 3 and 4 pence, we're going to a dance. And that actually happened in the First World War. Instead, send reinforcements, we're going to advance. It gets send 3 and 4 pence, we're going to a dance. What do these generals want money from the soldiers for? And actually, that's what happens in your memory. So when you remember just, you know, when, you know, what happened last year and when you went on holiday, you actually remember the last time you remembered that, which was the time, that time you're remembering the last time you're remembering it. So your memory is a chain of Chinese whispers. And every time you get a slight little error, so by the time you remember, say, a year back, there's so many errors you can't trust it. And that's why we have arguments on who did what. And we can't be sure. But the other type, that's the type of memory to sort of let go of because it's so untrustworthy. But the memories of past lives, you're right back there. You know, it is like a present moment memory because, you know, that past is now in your present, totally there for you. That is useful. One thing, it just shows you how powerful this mind is. It also shows you there is such a thing as past lives. And it gives you the big picture. So that was recommended by the Buddha. And play about with that. If you get a good meditation, you're getting very peaceful and after it's about to come out of it, just mention that. What's my earliest memory? Many people do that and they get some interesting results. It's one of the ladies, she's not here on this retreat, so I don't mind telling the story. She did that. And she got like a very, what you usually get, you know, same as me, just you get the early life memories first, you know, when you were a baby. So she actually remembered herself as like a baby in her mother's arms, sucking at the breast. She's about 40-year-old woman at that time. And then she remembered being a baby at the breast. And just, you know, like me, you could actually move around and look up, and she looked up and, oh my God, that's not my mum. It was a totally different woman suckling her. And so in the interview, she came to me and she was really upset. She said, look, you know, it worked, but I got a shock. I don't think that my mother is my biological mum. Because I was there, and it was clear. And the one who was cradling me, that was not my mother. So I said, well look, you know, when you get back, you better go and ask your mother. And so she did, after the retreat. And she told me about a week afterwards, she chose an opportunity, went up to her mum and said, Mum, is there anything you haven't told me? What do you mean? Are you my real mum? And mother was shocked.
What are you talking about? Of course I'm your mother. What are you asking that question for? And then this 40-year-old girl told the story. And the mother was even more dumbfounded. How the heck can you remember that? Because from the description, the mother knew that was her wet nurse. She came from quite a wealthy family, and they'd organized a wet nurse, like a nanny, to feed her. And only for the first few weeks. And in the meditation, she got a perfect recall, describing detail, and her mother recognized, yeah, that was your nanny, I am your mum. That's amazing what you can do. And that was a sort of a sign of what she actually saw was true, because it was totally out of left field. It shocked her. It wasn't what she wanted to see. No one wants to see that the person you really think is your mother may not be your mum. But she saw it and it was accurate, and her mother confirmed it. So that's interesting. So when you come out, give it a try. You never know what might happen. You might really find out who your mother is and who your dad was. Okay, so that's enough about seeing the Dhamma.